Hey, what's happening? Episode 112. I am Shane, and I am happy to have the news editor over at antiwar.com, Dave DeCamp. How are you doing, sir?
Good, Shane. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah.
So we're going to be talking about a few topics that I guess you can say are flying under the radar, you know, because there's a lot of other stories that we can talk about, but I think these are really important as well. And I think for, at the very least, to have other people who do watch the show or listen to it, they can at least have some, I guess, relevance of what's going on other than some of the other big stuff like COVID, you know, and all that other stuff. But anyway, so the first thing that I wanted to discuss with you, or at least touch on, is this story here. And again, these are going to be all of your articles over at antiwar.com, so we'll kind of just go over them and you can kind of elaborate on that. But the first one is titled Blinken Vows Firm Action Against Myanmar's Military. And so for those who don't know, Antony Blinken is Joe Biden's Secretary of State as of right now. And I guess they're calling it a coup, I suppose. So on February 1st, there was a coup in Myanmar, it's also known as Burma, and I think as far as I know the story, I think it was like the military basically took over the government or something like that. Is that pretty much how it went?
Yes. Yeah, so the military, they claimed election fraud in their November elections, and they took power on February 1st, and they jailed the leaders there, including Aung San Suu Kyi, who was like the de facto ruler. Mm-hmm. So in Myanmar, it was ruled by the military from the 1960s until they started reforms around 2010, I believe. And the U.S. had sanctions on Myanmar that were put into effect in the 90s, and Obama lifted them in 2016. And this woman, Aung San Suu Kyi, she was a Democratic reformer. She was in jail for years or on house arrest, and she was kind of this figure of Myanmar democracy. She kind of fell out of grace in recent years over the Rohingya. That's the Muslim ethnic group there that they accused the military of having genocidal intent, is how they put it. There was an ethnic cleansing. Some villages where there was some massacres, and it was really, you know, pretty horrible situation. A lot of these Rohingya have fled to Bangladesh. But the thing is, the military was always kind of in control from how I understand it. But again, I'm no Myanmar expert or anything. But anyway, so on February 1st, the military officially took charge again. And the Biden administration reacted. President Biden demanded the military relinquish control. And they just hit some military leaders and their families and businesses with sanctions. And Blinken, the Secretary of State, who is really awful. I mean, he's about as bad as you can get. He is just threatening kind of more action. There's been protests. There's some violence at the protests. And with Asia, we're going to talk about China, but the Biden administration is prioritizing Asia to counter China. So this is going to be something to keep an eye on. See how far the U.S. will go in intervening in Myanmar here, which it was called Burma until not that long ago. The U.S. government, I forget the reason, but they still call it Burma. So in all the statements, it's a little confusing. You'll see them call it Burma. But yeah, so that's what's happening. It's an area to keep an eye on. Like I said, how far could they go? Are they going to start sending weapons to an opposition group? I think I joked about that on Twitter, but you know, anything is possible to these people in the White House. And like I said, the focus on Asia.
Yeah. So one of the quotes here that I guess Blinken wrote on Twitter here in the article, it says, "The United States will continue to take firm action against those who perpetrate violence against the people of Burma as they demand the restoration of their democratically elected government. We stand with the people of Burma." It kind of seems that, because you're saying, when you're just saying that the military has basically been in control. I mean, I guess you can kind of say that any military is in control because they're basically the war faction of the government, right? So, mm-hmm. So here in Myanmar, Burma, I don't know, whatever. I don't even know. I'll just say Myanmar because that's kind of, I'll just say that Myanmar. Yeah. It kind of just seems that because they didn't like who was in charge, I guess they just decided, okay, we're just going to take over because we don't like this person. And then the Biden administration is saying, no, we want this person back in charge or whatever. And so now they're kind of, like with the sanctions and anything like that, it's kind of like, well, we might do something militarily. It's kind of like with the Venezuela thing that they were trying to do under Trump. And I'm sure Biden's going to be trying to send something over there with Venezuela as well. It's kind of similar.
It hasn't gotten to that level yet because in Venezuela and countries like Iran and North Korea, the sanctions, they have just insane sanctions on these countries that are just like decimating the economy and stuff. Myanmar, they're saying that they're going to keep the money going to like the, what they call civil society groups. Cause a lot of money, US money goes to Myanmar, but a little of it went to the government because the military was always kind of in control. I don't know if it'll get to that level with the sanctions where they start blacklisting the country's like financial sector and stuff. I mean, we'll see. Like I said, just something kind of to keep an eye on.
Yeah, and this is one of those stories that I'm pretty sure I said at the beginning where it's like pretty much under the radar or very few eyes are on, especially with the, I guess the mainstream audiences or anything like that. When they watch corporate press, you know, they whatever the CNN's telling them, okay, that's what I like, cool, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And so I don't watch CNN, so I don't know. Like, I don't have that.
I think the protests are being covered a lot.
Really?
Okay. Yeah. Which is a sign, which usually when that happens, like, you know, you can tell which countries are in the US's radar when the way the media covers the protests.
Right.
Like kind of the more coverage on a, like it was like that with Hong Kong. It was just in our face for months during the Hong Kong protests for months when there's protests happening all over the world that we didn't really see as much. But I'm not the best judge. I haven't been watching CNN and stuff. I read the mainstream. I read AP and Reuters and stuff and New York Times every day. And I have seen decent amount of coverage of the protests. So,
okay. All right. Yeah. So in relation to what's going on in Myanmar, the bigger picture is with China in general.
Yeah.
And it's like a joke, I guess, with right wingers, I suppose, where they're like, oh, Joe Biden is, he's being controlled by Xi Jinping or China in general. And it kind of sounds similar to when Donald Trump was president. Oh, he's just he's Putin's puppet or whatever.
Yeah.
And then you look more into it, obviously, with Trump, and he's like pretty hawkish with Trump, at least he and his administration.
Yeah. He's a huge Russia hawk.
Yeah. So the first thing that I want to mention, and these kind of go in chronological order.
Mm.
And this is Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen. So the Treasury Chief, this is the headline, Treasury Chief, Trump's China tariffs will stay for now, which is, it's so funny that they'll always say that, oh, Donald Trump is this, rebel or this outcast or whatever you want to call him, outlaw in as president. And then stuff like this goes, oh, well, Trump's China tariffs, they were bad, but we're going to keep him because he wasn't strong enough on China or something like that. Dumb stuff they say. According to Yellen, this quote here in this article from you, for the moment, we have kept the tariffs in place that were put in by the Trump administration. We'll evaluate going forward what we think is appropriate. They're doing a lot of reviews and evaluations on what Trump did in foreign policy. It's kind of funny.
Yeah. 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 That's what it's, everything is about now. They're reviewing everything that was left with China, with the trade stuff. They've kind of said this. Biden was even saying it on the campaign trail and right after he was elected that they're not going to change the tariffs or that phase one trade deal that Trump signed with China at the beginning of 2020.
Yeah.
That they're not going to change it immediately, or they're leaving it in place for now. And, funny enough, you're talking about Biden, how there's this idea that he's soft on China, that he's controlled on China. One thing that I've been watching closely is the Senate confirmation hearings. And every Biden nominee, you know, they said China was not the top adversary, competitor, however they worded it. And Anthony Blinken said, oh, Trump was right to take a hard approach, to take a tough approach to China. So they like his China policy. They might not have done it the same way as aggressively with all the, because there's also, besides the tariffs, there's been a lot of trade blacklists, export blacklists for Chinese companies with alleged military ties. And those are all still in place. Huawei, the 5G, the company that specializes in 5G, the Chinese company, there's all these blacklists for them. So all that's still in place. And like they said, they're reviewing it. But the, with the rhetoric, the way that they've been talking about China, I know a lot of people have focused on what Biden said during a recent CNN town hall, but when you look at the policy, what's actually happening, it's just going the same way as Trump. And it's really dangerous to me, this is like kind of what everything is about now. And if you look at the South China Sea and the Taiwan Strait and the U.S. military activity in the region, that really stepped up in the last year. Trump, you know, COVID kind of set his hardline China policy into like hyperdrive, and all the more ships started sailing near China's coast. And since Biden's been in office, that's continued, and the pace that it's at, it almost seems like it might be more military activity. He's already sent two ships through the Taiwan Strait. He's sent two ships near the Chinese claimed islands in the South China Sea. Two aircraft carriers went in, drilled there, which is a very rare thing. The last time it happened was in July of 2020. Mm-hmm. And the last time before that, it was like 2014 or something. You know, it's a big show of force. And Biden's going to be better at, they want to build like a NATO type alliance in Asia. And Biden's going to be better at that than Trump and his State Department. So yeah, that's where everything is moving.
Yeah. Speaking of that, there's other article that I wanted to share as well. So you're talking about how like Biden and his administration is going to be better in terms of like NATO and everything like that. So with this one, which is interesting, because just going with that, this headline is Biden administration rejects China's calls for better relations. So it seems that China, maybe they understand where, I guess, Biden and his administration are coming from, I suppose, in terms of, you know, they, okay, so a new president is in, you know, we want to do, I guess, something at least a little different. I don't know. And yeah, so in this article, the first paragraph is that in the wake of the Trump administration, U.S.-China relations are at their lowest point in decades. For weeks now, Chinese officials have been calling for better relations. And so one of the quotes here from one of the Chinese foreign ministers says, "We stand ready to have candid communication with the U.S. side and engage in dialogues aimed at solving problems." And he also called on the U.S. to lift trade restrictions and stop interfering in China's internal affairs. The U.S. responded sharply to Wang's remarks. And so it seems that, you know, and just going off of that foreign minister, you know, I don't know how many of the other Chinese officials agree with that or what those type of relations. I mean, who knows at this point? But it just seems that, this guy wants better relations with us. I don't think so. I think we're going to continue to do what we're doing, you know. And then kind of going down into the article, says that so far President Biden's China policy is looking a lot like his predecessors. And like you were saying, you know, warships going over there in the area, and the tariffs and everything like that. So it just seems that, and maybe, I don't know, I guess in a way this could be similar to how when people were calling, like I was saying before, Donald Trump as this Putin puppet or anything like that. Oh, he's working with Russia and Russian collusion and all this crap. I don't know if Biden is this smart or anything like that, or he just has smart people around him, just like with Donald Trump. I don't know how smart he is. I mean, who knows? Who really knows? But it's kind of like, okay, so these people are saying that I am pro China, or, you know, I'm pro CCP or anything like that. Well, let me show you how I'm not pro China and pro CCP by being extremely hawkish towards China and being really tough on them and pounding my fist on the table and saying, this is how it's going to go because we're America and we have bigger dicks than you. Right. So like, how do you think that kind of is going down in terms of their relationship?
Yeah, well, so with Trump, the whole Russia thing, I mean, that was the, it was, I think, more than what's happening with Biden. You know, it was like the entire intelligence and media establishment kind of working together to call Trump a Putin puppet. And I do think that did drive Trump to have such a hardline Russia policy, even though he kind of never gave them the rhetoric that they wanted to hear. He would say, like to Putin, oh, why don't you interfere in the thing? Or thanks for whatever, you know.
Right.
It's really funny. But the real policy was really dangerous. He was scrapping nuclear treaties. The last nuclear treaty between the U.S. and Russia, the New START, it limits the amount of bombers and missiles that each country can have deployed. It was going to expire in February. Biden renewed it right away. So even though Biden's the guy that talks tougher on Russia, he moved quicker to renew the treaty. That is really dangerous stuff. Because if that treaty expired, the last thing anybody, any of us, any Russians, any Chinese need is a new nuclear arms race. Just an insane waste of money. And it's just incredibly dangerous. It's just, it only benefits a very few arms manufacturers and stuff. But with China, it's a little less. It's more the right-wing media and the right-wing. I was going to say the right-wing mainstream like Fox, but it is. I do see independent media doing the same exact thing. Mm-hmm. They're calling Biden a puppet of Xi, and some of it goes back to that Hunter Biden. He made some money in China using the Biden name, which I don't think that gives – nobody cares about that. For like the Democrat – no Biden voters, that didn't faze them. They just compartmentalized it or something. But again, if you look at the policy – so a few examples of this – shift and focus on Asia is the National Security Council was reshuffled to focus on Asia. They downsized the Middle East department and they increased the amount of people working in Asia, which is significant. It shows something. And the Pentagon is also, like you said, there's all these reviews going on. They have a task force reviewing China policy, Asia policy. And the guy leading it, his name is Eli Ratner. His new post, he was appointed to be an advisor for Lloyd Austin, the Secretary of Defense, because a lot of Republicans didn't think Austin was hawkish enough on China. Eli Ratner is like an insane China hawk. He's published all these essays about how we have to face China and stuff. And he wrote an op-ed in last year titled something like President Trump has been weak on China and the American people paid the price or whatever. So this is the guy leading the review. It's a Pentagon review. It's going to take a few months. They're going to look at the posture in the region. Sometimes these reviews are kind of meaningless, but I think that there's no way at the end of this review, he's going to be like, you know what? We could start, pulling back from the region. We could close. We don't need to make a deal with the Philippines, a troop deal with the Philippines. We can close some bases, bring the aircraft carriers home. There's no, it's going to be more, oh, we need a base in Singapore or wherever. And that and the military stuff. And a lot of people might think that these military operations, they don't really change with administration, but I think there was a significant change under Trump during the COVID stuff when things got really tense with China, the ships started sailing there more often. It's connected. It's completely connected. And Obama started these maneuvers to challenge China's claims to the South China Sea. Trump ramped them up, and Biden, it looks like he's going to ramp them up too. So it's just to continue. It's about world domination because China, they want a piece of their own backyard, and the U.S. doesn't want that.
Yeah, that piece that you were talking about from Eli Ratner, it was called Trump Has Been Weak on China and Americans Have Paid the Price.
Yeah.
And I mean, just reading that title alone, you're kind of scratching your head like, I don't even know what this, I guess we're looking at the world completely different because, like you were saying when COVID was happening, he was basically calling it the China flu and everything like that. And just, I don't know. It's interesting to to kind of see how when Joe was running us, it's like, I don't even know how anyone could be surprised by some of this. And so you were saying earlier about how they were basically increasing the numbers in Asia in terms of the staff, but they were decreasing the numbers of staff in the Middle East. Like, so what exactly does that actually mean? Does that, because I know when Joe Biden was campaigning, he was saying about the Yemen war, wanting to stop that and everything like that. Does that have something to do with that? Or is there kind of more to it?
With the National Security Council, I mean, that just means that they're going to have more, it's a bureaucratic thing, more people discussing what to do in Asia than the Middle East. Mm-hmm. But Biden has, I mean, this is what he's done in Yemen so far is pretty encouraging. It's not, he's not doing it quick enough, in my opinion. I think the blockade is still being enforced. You've had Scott on, right? Your viewers are pretty familiar with that war. But that's moving in a good direction, what's happening in Yemen. It's still, I mean, the fighting is still raging. The Saudis are still bombing the country. People are still starving to death. And as the war drags on, it's really horrible. But Biden's Middle East policy, they're also conducting a review of that, of like the war on terror. And interestingly, there hasn't been any airstrikes in Somalia since Biden came in. That's a place Trump ramped up the air war. Mm-hmm. The only confirmed airstrikes have been in Iraq. There was a suspected one in Syria. It's really Iraq and ISIS. But let me, I'm kind of all over the place. what I see, and this is kind of a prediction, and it's not, I could be wrong. I don't see any major escalations in the Middle East. I see maybe fortification, like in Northeast Syria. We might get up to like a few thousand troops there. I think at its peak under Trump, there's 2,000 troops in Syria. And kind of just control that area of Syria, keep the sanctions on Syria, keep supporting the Kurds, and that'll be the status quo for a while in Syria, I think. And then in Iraq, NATO is increasing its forces in Iraq from 500 to about 4,000. And I think that's going to kind of stay the same. There's 2,500 U.S. troops. They're focused on ISIS. ISIS is, you know, coming back now that Biden's in. But so fortification, if the Iraqi government lets it stay, I mean, that's an area, you know, these aren't controlled things. There could be a big escalation there if the militias, if they're not having it and they start attacking NATO and the U.S. more. But I just see the Middle East status quo, drone wars will continue to an extent. But the focus is going to be on China and also on Russia and NATO and stuff and the Arctic. That's the next frontier for the U.S. military. We just sent bombers to Norway for the first time. What else is going on over there? In the Black Sea, there's been a lot of activity there. But yeah, I feel like I just went on a tangent. But
no, it was funny that you were mentioning how the Arctic is going to be like a new realm or something. I'm just thinking, so they're going to start bombing penguins or wherever they live up there. Like, we can't have any more penguins. We got to bomb them all.
But one thing worth mentioning is a lot of this hinges on the Iran nuclear deal too. If Biden ever revives it and lifts sanctions, because that could just calm things down a lot in the region. But right now it's not looking like it. All of Trump's sanctions are still in place. It's literally the same policy. They're trying to get Iran to come to the table while they have these sanctions in place. So they said that they're willing to talk to Iran last week, but they're still making demands for a stricter deal and Iran's not going to go for that. So that might just be the same for a while too. So that's not a good sign.
Yeah. Does Iran wants to go back to what the original deal was before Trump decided he wanted to scrap it? Because Obama did it, so I got to scrap whatever Obama did in terms of that, you know. And so it's so frustrating, though, because with the whole Iran thing, some people weren't fans of the nuclear deal because, you know, Iran's this big, bad, evil country, you know, the big boogeyman, right, in the Middle East. I mean, I think we kind of know exactly why Iran is. I don't want to get the platformed or anything like that.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. The whole thing is just ridiculous, but
it is. And the media coverage is insane. That's one thing. I mean, if you look at antiwar.com, you look at the news section, one thing me and Jason Ditz have just been writing about every day is this stuff with Iran. And a lot of it is just like what this story is like, what the media is saying just isn't true. They say that Iran's violating the deal, but Iran isn't bound by the deal anymore since the U.S. pulled out, and just things like that. So that's another thing. That's why people should read antiwar.com.
Yeah. And correct me if I'm wrong on that deal, but America or like the U.S. government, they were basically saying that Iran, like, I don't, was like abused the deal or something like that. But in reality, it was the opposite. Correct?
Well, they, when Trump withdrew, it was right after Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, he had this whole presentation about how there's like this secret nuclear weapons program in Iran.
That's what they've been saying for like the last 1,000 years, right?
Yeah. So they were saying that they weren't abiding by it and that they were doing the secret program, which just, I mean, there was no real evidence for that. And if people want to read about that, read Gareth Porter, either on antiwar.com or he writes at the Gray Zone now, but, that's his specialty. Read his book, Manufactured Crisis. But yeah, I mean, and right now, like this, the demands that the Biden administration is making, it's just not going to go anywhere. Cause Iran's been, they're willing to reverse every step they've taken to go back to the deal. And there's a lot of domestic pressure for Rouhani, the president, who's considered a moderate, to say, fuck the U.S. Stop. Like, why do you keep putting up with this? You know,
yeah.
You made a deal, they pulled out of it, and now they're not even really trying to revive it. And you're like, because they want to kind of make their economy sanctions proof. And that's what is going to happen. That's going to be the end result of all of this, Venezuela and Iran and North Korea. Like, you put these countries out of the U.S. global banking system, and then you're just going to get them to start working together and then probably sign deals with China the more we isolate China.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the end result.
So in terms of the Iran nuclear deal, like basically, so the whole thing basically was that, you know, kind of a little bit of the history, at least as far as I know, like, you know, Obama went into it and they made the deal or anything like that. But then because of that, because people were mad at him and his administration for doing that, that's when they started another war. I believe it was Syria or Libya. I can't remember which one exactly it was. You know, the whole story about, you know, placating the Saudis and all that.
Yeah, that was Yemen.
Yemen. And they were mad at us. Oh, okay, we'll do this for you to do this. So what? So what happens if, say, they do agree to go back into the deal, both Iran and the U.S. and everything like that? They go back into it. Do you think that the same thing is going to happen where Saudi Arabia or whoever is going to be mad at Biden or whoever is that does it, and they go, okay, well, to appease you, we'll start something else. Like, maybe we'll start a war in some other random Middle Eastern country or something like that to keep you guys happy.
I mean, that's possible. I would think more so maybe with give Israel something, not quite annexation of the West Bank, but
yeah,
stuff like that. For the Saudis, it's tough to say. I mean, that's one thing I was afraid of. Like, if they were to return to the Iran deal, would they then keep the Yemen war going?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, it's tough to say. Like I said, the war in Yemen's not over yet. The UK is still selling a bunch of weapons to the Saudis, and the US reaffirmed its like commitment to defending Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
Because the Houthis, they shoot rockets and drones into Saudi Arabia because the Houthis in Yemen, because Saudi Arabia has been waging this brutal war on them for almost 6 years now. And they act like it's offensive attacks from Yemen. It's just like total nonsense. But so there's a lot of loopholes, a lot of ways. And they said that the war against Al-Qaeda in Yemen is going to continue. And that's a whole different war. That's the thing. People kind of know Obama more for his drone war against Al-Qaeda in Yemen. And Trump escalated that in 2017. I believe there was a study about this from Air Wars. They're like a monitoring group. Mm. Trump bombed Yemen more in that war, not in the war against the Houthis, in the war against Al-Qaeda, carried out more bombings and raids than Obama did and Bush combined. And then that, but then that de-escalated. So there was only like 5 U.S. drone strikes against Al-Qaeda in Yemen last year or something. And if Biden returns to the nuclear deal, he could certainly try to placate the Saudis in another way or Israel. I mean, a lot of hinges on that for the Middle East, for even the China policy. There was a story in Politico from an author whose name I'm blanking on, but she's really not trustworthy. And she had sources tell her that the Biden administration is deprioritizing the Middle East, which I kind of believe. But I mean, if they actually want to do that, returning to the Iran deal and lifting sanctions on Iran is the way to do it. Not that I agree with why they want to do it and go focus on China, but
yeah,
if they really want to get out of there. And it's another thing. I mean, I think it's just going to be more proxies. It's not like we're going to stop fucking with the Middle East. It's just going to be the status quo, more proxies, Saudi Arabia, UAE, Israel. They're going to be kind of fighting our wars. NATO, because NATO just did the little troop surge in Iraq. It's mm-hmm. going to be more of that than U.S. troops doing it. And the American public, they don't care or notice if American troops aren't dying, which they learned from Trump and Obama to an extent with his drone wars. But you would never know it, but Trump bombed. He broke records for the number of bombs dropped on Afghanistan in 2018 and 2019. But because U.S. troops were dying, people didn't even know we were still in Afghanistan.
Well, the main thing with Trump's foreign policy is the fact that he didn't, quote unquote, start any new wars.
Yeah.
You know? But I mean, I guess with the war thing, you can kind of say, well, he kind of started a war with China and the trade and everything like that. So I guess that's technically a, you know.
Yeah. I mean, and I do. It is good that that's something right wingers, kind of populist types are proud of Trump for. It's not starting new wars. It's kind of, he kind of shifted the narrative,
mm-hmm.
which is good, but I don't know.
But yeah, I mean, when you drop more bombs than Bush and Obama, I mean, he's like the epitome. Anytime I think of W now, it's all I think about is 9/11 and the war on terror and him starting it and the whole mission accomplished on that ship, whatever. Yeah, it's over. Oh, okay. Well, I guess if you're a freaking fifth grader, I suppose that's what it is, because, oh, it says mission accomplished on that big sign behind him. Wow. This is awesome. Thanks a lot, Bush. Appreciate it. So if they're going to, like you were saying, kind of going with that article from that lady that you were talking about, if they're going to shift their priorities from the Middle East or even Iran, for example, to China, I guess in their perspective, kind of playing that role, they kind of go, well, and it's like you were saying with their China being the top adversary that was mentioned earlier, you know, they're a superpower, as I guess you can say. Iran isn't a superpower. I mean, I don't think they are. I mean, like, you know, like, what is Iran going to do? Like, can they like shoot a missile up in the air and it's going to land in America in a few hours? Well, I don't know. I would probably say no at this point, right? I mean, but they make it seem like they're oh, if we don't do anything, they're going to do anything to us any second, any day now, right? But with China, you can kind of, I guess you can kind of understand where they're coming from, because China is the superpower and, you know, they have a whole bunch of people, their government's really strong, and America's got to do something about them. So I guess in a way, we're just going to not trade with them. That's how we're going to stop this. That's how we're going to make them bleed or anything like that. And you said something on your Twitter account when you were like, you know, I think trading with China is a good thing. I don't know why this is so controversial for me to say or whatever, but I guess if we have, if we trade with China, then I guess we love China. We love the Chinese government, what they do 100% all the time, right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's what kind of worries me, is that there's this talk. There's like starting to be serious talk about decoupling from China. Trump said it a few times, but if you actually look at the numbers, it's like an insane thing to even think of, how reliant our economies are on each other. But Tom Cotton, the crazy hawkish senator, he just released the plan I think it was called like To Beat China or something was the title.
Oh, how blatant.
Yeah, yeah. And it called and it called for a strategic decoupling. And there was a study from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce that said decoupling would cost, you know, hurt our economy, but they said it was an inevitable thing. And the real risk, I think, in cutting off trade and decoupling with China, but besides having to figure out how we're going to, you know, afford a television, is that there goes the reason not to go to war with them. Cause that the reason why war right now isn't like a major concern is because if you look at, we can't go to war with China. We can't. And besides the fact that they have nukes, that should stop us anyway, but just how reliant we are, our supply chains and stuff and business interests that people have. There's so many like layers to this, but there's that old saying, like if goods don't cross borders, then armies soon will. Like trade is good. And this whole narrative, and if you look at the whole trade war thing, the whole China thing, the biggest talking point is that they steal our IP, our intellectual property. And, you know, they're not, you know, ripping off antiwar.com articles over in China. It's technology of the corporations that are doing business there. And the whole trade war was kind of launched to protect the intellectual property of these big corporations. And I know a lot of libertarians that don't even think intellectual property and patents and copyrights should even be a thing. And that's what a lot of this is over, is that they, and other countries, how many other countries do that? I'm sure the US does their fair share of that. And there's all these like Chinese American scientists and researchers and stuff in colleges, they're getting arrested. For like stealing ideas or whatever and not disclosing their ties with the Chinese government. And who knows how, this is the FBI. So who knows how real these claims are? And people kind of just, oh, he was a Chinese spy working at that university or whatever. But yeah, so a lot of it is just protecting the ideas of Apple and stuff. And that's another thing. It's like, you think about how this is all able to happen. If we have all these corporations have this interest in good relations with China and having doing business in China. So then how is this all happening? How is this the narrative that everybody hates China now? And I think a big part of it is that these Chinese companies are starting to actually compete with our major corporations. And you get Trump to ban Huawei, the 5G company, which, you know, and again, I'm a libertarian. The idea of having like Chinese surveillance technology around me, I don't like, but I also understand that I already kind of have that around me and my government has access to it. And that's what I'm concerned about. And a big part of it too is the NSA. There's leaks, Snowden leaks that said the NSA was like, we got to figure out these Huawei phones because we can't, that we don't have a back door into them. And that's a part of it. That's a part of why the US doesn't want other countries to build their cell phone infrastructure with Chinese technology, because maybe NSA can't access it.
And that's why Snowden is such a huge enemy to the government, because of those type of things. And
yeah,
it's an interesting point that you're bringing up, because you know, like compete from a country is competing with another in terms of their, you know, like from Apple versus Huawei or whatever, you know, but they both have phones and, you know, they both can, you know, because what if Huawei started selling, like what if they were like the number two best-selling phone company, other than, I mean, you have Samsung, and Samsung is a Korean company, but you know, that's okay. But when it comes to Huawei or other Chinese companies that are coming in, we can't have that. And then the same with the whole like spying apparatus and everything like that. It's like, oh, we can't have Chinese spy technology over here in America, but American spy technology, oh, that's a-okay in my book. You know, it's
especially now with this. This is another thing about the Biden administration, the domestic terrorism stuff with the Capitol. They're talking about passing these laws. I mean, that's such a slippery slope, especially for people who have like a political ideology that is like a right wing or appears to be right wing to people that don't really understand it. And I mean, it's just, if you think you're on a watch list now, it's like, just wait until these new laws are passed. And
well also it depends on who's in there, because, you know, first they were, when Trump was in, you know, trying to label like Antifa as a domestic terrorist organization. And now that Biden's, we're going to make the Proud Boys or anyone that quote unquote stormed the Capitol, this insurrection or coup or whatever word they're going to come up with that defines that. Those people that did all that, those are the real domestic terrorists. So now basically domestic terrorists just throwing, it's just been thrown around like the word Nazi or racist. It's like, you're a domestic terrorist because you did something against the government. No, you are.
Yeah, it's horrible. I mean, I saw somebody, like, my Facebook is kind of, it's not really, it's just people I went to high school with and family. Yeah. It's not like Twitter. It's just totally out of my like political life. And I saw people like, this is the domestic terrorist that was killed storming the Capitol, and like showing a picture of that woman that was shot in the neck. I mean, that's so horrible. Like the way that the discourse is. And for all the leftists, and I know some like decent leftists that are like calling them insurrectionists and shit. And this is going to be turned around on them maybe even quicker than it's going to be turned around on some right wingers. So, it's dangerous stuff. And the I just want to make a last point on China, because I know we want to talk about the Twitter stuff, but for like just our government right now wants us to think China's a bad guy and to put all this energy on China. And it's just to me, it just seems like an obvious distraction. China's, they're communists, so they're kind of an easy big bad guy. Their government is not nice. And then their treatment of the Uyghur Muslims, that's what everybody wants to focus on.
Yeah.
But the U.S. government, has killed millions of Muslims this century. They don't care about the Uyghur Muslims. People just need to be more vigilant about these narratives. And I've seen this idea from people, and it like really pisses me off, like that they think that the corporate press or whatever you call it is not in on this anti-China stuff. Like, this is where everything's come from. This is where all the reports about Xinjiang and the Uyghurs and like all the leaks, and it's from the New York Times, it's from BBC and CNN and all these, you know, that's where this is all coming from. And it might be amplified more on Fox News or on like One America News or whatever, but they're all lockstep, just because Rachel Maddow talks about Russia more than Tucker Carlson talks about China more. Like, it's just, it's China. It's all about China. And there's money to be made for every worst aspect of our government surrounding China. I mean, how long were we going to be able to act like these Islamist groups in the Middle East were like a threat to us? Now we got China and they're just a big bad threat, and they're going to want to, you know, spend a lot of money and pass a lot of laws to stop them or whatever. So,
yeah, just imagine if it's like part of the worst situation is, say, America and China do go to war. It's of some kind or whatever, whether it is like a huge military conflict or anything like that. And like America goes into China and I don't know, just starts killing people or anything like that, anyone they deem evil. And then the same thing's going to happen where there's, you know, blowback's going to come back. Yeah. And, because that's, you know, when Ron Paul said, well, the reason why they attacked us is because we're over there killing them. So why wouldn't the Chinese do the same thing? They go, you Americans are killing us. We're butting heads sometimes, but other times we're friends. But now, no, we're not going to be friends anymore because you're killing our people at your hands. And then they're going to, these Chinese groups are going to start coming out and being birthed out from all these people. And then they're going to start attacking Americans. And then, I don't know, whatever the equivalent of a Chinese ISIS would be, but I would definitely, it wouldn't surprise me if that is something like that would happen, because that's kind of what happens when you have stuff like that. Cause we see it now with the Middle East and all the wars that are happening there, is that all these different groups are being spawned out of it. You know, first it was Al Qaeda, and then we take their side against some other terrorist organization or whatever you want to call them. And then now we're going to flip and we're going to take their side against so-and-so. And it's just like, man, how complicated can you get? How much more complicated can you get, you know?
Yeah. I mean, and that's one thing, a lot of the stuff that the U.S. government or whoever accuses China of is stuff that the U.S. does, or some of like the more like crazy hawks. Like I've seen people blame, say China was involved in like the Black Lives Matter protests or something, but it's like the U.S. was involved in the Hong Kong protests, was funding that and stuff.
Yeah, I remember when Ted Cruz went over there to go help with the protest, didn't he?
Did he? He actually went there?
Maybe. I don't know. I think I, for some reason, I remember Ted Cruz and Hong Kong protest something.
They came here. All these Hong Kong protest leaders came to D.C. and probably met Ted Cruz and testified before Congress pleading for like U.S. intervention.
Mm.
And like you just put the shoe on the other foot. It almost sounds like a cliche point to make when you talk about this stuff. But imagine a Black Lives Matter protester went to Beijing and like asked for help from China. You know, like it's insane.
Not only that, but how many Chinese people even know what Black Lives Matter even is? Like, like if a Black Lives Matter protest went over to China or Japan, and they're like, well, what is this guy talking about? Like, you know, it's like if some Chinese protester came over here and started protesting something about Chinese topics, we're like, what? I don't know. You know, I'm confused.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, before we get to China, the Twitter stuff, I do want to talk about the Uyghur stuff, because that's the main thing that I think a lot of the people are saying. It reminds me of like when Trump threatened to bring troops home from, I think it was Syria or wherever, and then they're like, oh, what about the Kurds? And then after that, nobody even cares about the Kurds anymore. You like, what's a Kurd? I don't know. You know, that whole thing. But at that moment in time, oh, we worry about the Kurds and their livelihood, right? And now it seems like it's this is one of those things where you have to put like a caveat in there. It's not like we're saying, oh yeah, whatever, what's happening with them, we totally agree with that. You know, well, it's a horrible situation, you know, and we're not saying that the Chinese government is this happy-go-lucky, awesome thing or whatever. I mean, it's like with the U.S. government, they do a lot of horrible stuff too. But it's not, it wouldn't be something where what would happen if the U.S. did actually intervene and said, okay, we're going to stop this genocide or whatever you want to call it, because some people kind of aren't even, some people say that it is genocide, other people are saying it's not a genocide or whatever. But what would happen if the U.S. did actually intervene? Like, what would you think would happen after that?
Well, I mean, the U.S., it depends on what level of intervention it is. I mean, if we like invaded Xinjiang with the army, I mean, we can't do that stuff with China. We have a lot less power in China than in little countries in the Middle East.
Do you think people who think that and are afraid of that, do you think they automatically just go, well, China's going to just shoot their nukes at us then? Like, that's it. Like, do you think that would happen?
I mean, it's tough to say. It's just such like they might they could shoot their nukes. I if we actually invaded China, I don't know. I mean, they might not shoot their nukes, but it would be an insane war. But if you look at like the more realistic like possibilities of intervention in Xinjiang, you know, there is with this narrative going on there. There is a possibility, I think. Well, the U.S. is already funding, you know, kind of maybe not separatist activity, but the National Endowment for Democracy is in Xinjiang. For people who don't know what that is, it's an organization. It's funded by the taxpayer money. The U.S. government allocates it, its budget.
Oh, great. So it's my fault. Awesome.
Yeah. and it's basically like a CIA cutout. How it's described is it does stuff that the CIA used to do more covertly. Like it funds pro-democracy stuff in all these countries around the world. Democracy. Yeah. It's kind of this soft imperialism that the US does that and USAID. The best example of it I could give is that in Bolivia, Evo Morales, who was couped in 2019, his government was voted back in Bolivia, but he kicked USAID out of Bolivia in like 2013. And every media outlet was like, oh, this crazy leftist, leader paranoid. But then if you go look at the programs that the USAID and the NED were funding in Bolivia, it was all separatist stuff, like anti-Morales separatist activity. Like, what would we do if China was just funding, say, Colorado? Like, oh yeah, Colorado should secede from the US. Would we just let them do it? No, we would kick them out. So But yeah, it's just an example of kind of the soft power that a lot of people don't realize. And like, could the U.S. arm send weapons to the Uyghurs? Yeah, I could see that happening. And then what is that? What would happen if China was sending weapons to, say, Antifa? Let's give it like the right wingers there.
Oh, man. Oh.
Yeah. And with China and Xinjiang, because that would be, we would say we're at war with, maybe to China, it would be as if we were at war with them. But then look around China, and maybe we already are kind of at war with them. If you look at the border in the Western Himalayas between China and India, remember there was a skirmish over the summer, 20 Indian troops died. The Chinese government finally disclosed their casualty amount. They said 5 troops died. Since then,
was that like a border dispute or something like that?
Yeah, it was like they got in like their soldiers don't have weapons there. So it was like a melee, like they beat each other and it seemed pretty crazy.
Yeah.
But we are now, since then, we signed a new military deal with India that we share with them satellite data. So we're helping India keep an eye on the Chinese troops at the border there. So what if there's like if there's another skirmish and more Chinese troops are dead, India is going to be using our intelligence to kill these Chinese troops. It's just like these things that are already going on that are just super provocative and would be if another government was doing it to our country. If we were killing people at the border of Mexico and China started helping those people or whatever. I mean, it's just an example. And in Xinjiang, what I see could happen is like try to balkanize that area and maybe fund some separatists. There's separatist groups. Some of them are more extreme than others. There's Al-Qaeda affiliates. And Uyghurs have gone to fight with the opposition in Syria and stuff. So that is an element of it. And I'm not justifying what the Chinese government is doing, but it's how they're handling terrorism. The U.S. government did it. I mean, it was outside of our borders mostly. Mm-hmm. We did it by droning people and stuff. They're doing it with these kind of re-education camps or whatever's really happening there. From what I understand, the Chinese government says they have vocational camps. The claim of genocide, I mean, nobody's claiming that they're rounding Uyghurs up in camps and executing them. It comes from the forced sterilization and stuff. And there's, you know, this stuff gets, people get very sensitive when you talk about this, especially libertarians. And they don't want to hear people question this because it sounds like you're a genocide denier. You're carrying water for the Chinese Communist Party or whatever. But you got to look at this stuff clear-eyed because the U.S. government, the State Department of the Trump administration declared it a genocide and Blinken said he agreed with it. So why is the U.S. government calling the situation a genocide and what is it really? You should want to actually really look into it. And the claims of forced sterilization, it comes from this guy, Adrian Zenz is his name. He's like kind of a crazy evangelical Christian type from what I understand. And I don't have a problem with people that are Christian, but he seems like he's a little more extreme.
Yeah.
And at the Gray Zone, Gareth Porter and Max Blumenthal, they wrote a report about the birth control and forced sterilization stuff. And kind of just look at the data and see what he does omit things. And you have to remember, you know, this isn't anything new. The Chinese government has done this stuff to the Han Chinese, the one child policy. Yeah. And that didn't apply to the ethnic minorities. They were always allowed to have more kids. And that, you know, like I said, it's not unique to the Uyghurs what's really been happening in China, and that doesn't excuse it, but that also doesn't mean it's just something people have to look at clear-eyed and understand that there's a reason why this stuff is in the news and why they're calling it a genocide. And it's not because they care about the Uyghur Muslims, because if they cared about Muslims, they would be pressuring Israel to end the blockade on Gaza, or thankfully Joe Biden is working to end the war in Yemen. But I mean, and then so I've brought this up before. I said, oh, what about the 2 million Muslims in Gaza? They live, it's basically an open air prison. They live under blockade. The unemployment rate for young men in Gaza is like 70%. Like imagine being in your early 20s. You have nowhere to go. You have no job. It's just the UN like gives you food and you have nothing. Yeah. And then so the people that say that they care about the Uyghurs, when they start explaining why Gaza is under blockade, they sound a lot like the Chinese government, you know? So explaining why the Uyghurs are in these camps or whatever is really happening there. So it's just manufactured, not manufactured. What's the word? Selective outrage. It is. Yeah. And then I know like people might think I'm a evil genocide denier for saying that, but it's the truth. You know, Yemen, I mean, you know about Yemen, and yeah. That's one thing that I'm really like kind of proud to be part of this anti-war libertarian website and stuff is that nobody fucking cares about the war in Yemen. Nobody cares about these kids that are being born into starvation, but a lot of libertarians are really good on it. And that's something that's what we got to focus on drawing attention to and ending before we ever have anything to say about what the Chinese government is doing to the Uyghurs.
Yeah. And it's interesting too, that you mentioned that there's libertarians out there who are kind of looking at the Uyghur situation in China and kind of just going with, I guess, the corporate press narrative, when at the same time, they'll complain about what the corporate press is saying 99.9% of the other time. But then that 0.01% when it comes to like this Uyghur situation, it's not all libertarians, but there's definitely some that I'm sure we've seen on there. You're just like, I can't believe you're taking this position.
Yeah.
You know, and it's one of those, it's one of those tough things that, yeah, it's something that you have to look at it clearly, but at the same time, it's kind of, it's really hard to know exactly what's happening unless, I guess, you're there, yeah. You know, because like, how are we supposed to trust what the Chinese government is saying? Because we can't even trust our own government. So how can we trust the Chinese government for saying, no, it's just a, you know, they're just, you know, they're just camps where, you know, they have plagues, they have playgrounds and they, you know, run around and all that stuff. So like, how do we know what there's, cause I mean, who knows? It could actually be them. Hey, if you say something wrong, we're going to take you to this camp and you're going to work hard, you know, with the labor camp or whatever. And we're going to kill you somehow, you know, I mean, who knows, that could be happening, but at the same time, we don't know because the US government is definitely trying to paint this as something. Yeah.
And sensationalizing it doesn't help. It doesn't help at all. Sensationalizing stuff like this. Cause then it kind of can give the Chinese government more of a leg to stand on. It, when people start to look into it, because I mean, just look into it. If people are like that are doubting it, see what the claims are. See, it's mostly satellite pictures of stuff and the BBC going to Xinjiang and somebody yelling in Chinese and them going like, they're not letting us in this factory. Like their camera crews just go around and it's like very, I do think I'm not one to like call things racist, but I think a lot of this Chinese stuff, there is definitely a racist element to it. Orientalist kind of like, especially with this. I mean, you look at these BBC, it's just like a guy in speaking Chinese and they're like, he's keeping, there's a bunch of Uyghurs in this building. And like, you have no idea really what's happening over there. And and China, people should go to China. People should just like think, just, I don't know, just think about this stuff more. And just, we can't go to war with China. Our government has no power to do anything over there. Anything we do is just going to hurt the situation. And we should just mind our own business and work on our own shit.
It would pretty much be World War III. Like for real, not just this, World War III is going to, like, it would be legit, you know, because the U.S. and their allies would probably be on that side. And then whoever's allying with China, they'll ally with them. And it's just going to be a huge thing where who knows how long it's going to last. You and I would probably have to be, you know, who knows, they bring in the draft because we don't have enough people. We got to have more people to fight this war. And then you and I,
yeah,
as an example, would have to go fight, you know. And I'm like, oh man, this would be the worst thing
for real. I mean, the way things are going, like not soon, but in 10, 20 years, I mean,
yeah.
And it's nukes, man. Like, man, it could just end the world. Like, it's a real thing. People don't really think about nukes anymore, but they're all still, there's not as many as there was, but there's thousands and thousands of them. And China has, they say China has about 320, and the US and Russia both have about 6,000. And they're trying to get China to like get into these nuclear arm control agreements. But before we like really dismantle our arsenal, China's not going to have any interest in that, because why would they limit their nukes at 300 when we have
I was going to ask about that, like if China and America would somehow get, like how US and Iran would go into a nuclear deal, would there ever be a possibility of US and China? But probably in what you're saying, it seems like that probably never happened, or at least it would be unlikely.
It would be, yeah, unless the US, you know, gets rid of a bunch of its nukes, dismantles its arsenal, to takes like a serious step to do that.
Yeah, and especially since, like you were saying, U.S. and China has like 5 or 6,000 nukes or whatever, and then China has like 600 or whatever. Mm-hmm. They're thinking, well, this 600 nukes that we have is supposed to be like defense in terms of like this exact case where, say, America invades.
Yeah.
What are we going to do? We have to defend ourselves somehow, you know? And so another thing that I wanted to mention real quick is that if this were to happen, like if this happened, it would be catastrophic, but then also sometimes you kind of just have to wonder how stuff like this happens, because I was thinking about other examples where they say, like you were saying, they're kind of like sensationalizing all this. So like when there's some like the, you know, babies in incubators, that thing, weapons of mass destruction, and you know, so they're going to keep crying wolf. And then what if this was like for real? This was for real, but who's going to take them seriously? Because they've lied us into other wars tons of other times. So why are we going to this all of a sudden? Oh, see, now you have to believe us for sure. This is, I know we've said this like 15,000 other times and we lied, but I swear 15,001, this is the one for sure. We're telling the truth.
And I feel weird. Like there's, you know, Uyghur people that have, they give like testimony and stuff about being like raped or stuff like that. I mean, it sounds really horrible, and I would never like go after these people ever, but there is a history of the U.S., you know, kind of coaching people like this. They did it in Tibet. And again, not that what the Chinese government has done in Tibet is good. But, you know, the Dalai Lama was on the CIA payroll and stuff like that. So the U.S., they get involved in this stuff. And like you said, the incubator babies, look at that woman's testimony, that girl's testimony. I think she was like 15.
Somewhere.
I would, at the time, I wouldn't be like, she's lying, but she was lying and she was coached by the U.S. So, I mean, these things do happen and we have to keep everything in mind and worry about our own government's atrocities and murder, because there's plenty of that. Yeah, if you want to just touch on the Twitter thing quick, there was this warning put on a Gray Zone article. The article was about, it showed that the UK government funded Reuters, and it was Bellingcat, if you know who they are. They're kind of the sketchy like investigation online thing. And they're funding them to weaken, like make Russia look bad in Russia and in like North Macedonia, I believe too. And, you know, they're instructed to like kind of undermine the Russian government.
Yeah.
And they wrote, you know, everything that they accuse Russia of, it was hacked from the British foreign, whatever their foreign ministry is called. But it was obtained in a hack. And then Twitter added this label, like, oh, these, I forget what it said exactly, but it said like, this is information that may have been obtained through hacking. And if you went to like the tweet, it would come up and it said, do you still want to like it? If you go to retweet it, it would come up. And there's so many examples of a lot of the China stuff. The New York Times has published is stuff that might've been hacked, but this is kind of it's a totally new thing. And, this started in the lead up to the 2020 election. Social media companies like YouTube and stuff, they started saying that they were going to censor or do something with like hacked information that was from a hacked material. And this is kind of the first concrete thing I've seen. And that, I think it comes from the 2016 election when WikiLeaks released the DNC emails, which they say was a Russian hack, but that's a claim that's never been proven. But
yeah,
you would never know it if you read the newspaper.
Yeah, so it said these materials may have been obtained through hacking. That's the label that comes on. Because I saw like Aaron Maté tweeted something about it and it came up, and then the Gray Zone, they show that, you know, themselves with that label too. So yeah,
people kind of turned it into like a meme. I think it got the article more reach. Kind of backfired on them. But yeah, stuff like that. Like they just took down some accounts that were supposedly tied to the Russian government. If you go on the Twitter blog, they put a thing in about it. And they said that they suspended these accounts because they were undermining the NATO alliance, which apparently can get you suspended from Twitter. It's very strange. I just saw this before. But yeah, I got to look into that more. Because it said that they were like Russian state affiliated, I guess they're hinting that they were bots, but it said they were undermining the NATO alliance. It's like, what?
Well, they're just a private company, bro, so they can do whatever they want.
Yeah, that's right.
Exactly. All right, yeah. All right, Dave. Well, again, I'm sorry for keeping you longer than I know we were planning on, but if you want to go ahead and plug wherever they can find you.
Read antiwar.com, subscribe to our daily newsletter. I write in the news section, try to keep people updated on all the goings-ons related to U.S. foreign policy and wars, and follow me on Twitter at DeCampDave, and that's it.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Dave, for coming on. Really appreciate it. This was a lot of good information. Hopefully people can look more into it. So, yeah, thanks everyone for watching and listening, and we will see you in the next one.